The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Let me give you a quick perception, which raises for me a very difficult issue. And I have to tell you just at the outset that I'm quite excited about having an opportunity to discuss specifically this topic with this group, because I sense that there's a large divergence of levels, of perceptions, of opinions with regards to Judaism in general and Torah study in particular. And so it was a bit of a challenge for me to come up with a perception and an idea that I thought on the one hand was so important for everybody and yet would be able to cross the boundaries of our different levels. And I have an underlying question which I want to ask you, but I'll maybe share with you just a quick story which for me more than any other that I can think of precedes this. It's a story which really was a journey. And it began in 1981, and it hit its apex somewhere about 1992. When I finished high school in 1981, now you can do your mathematics and figure it out, right? But when I finished high school, I came to Israel, and I had thought that I was going to come here for a year and study and learn. I had been in a yeshiva high school, and I wanted to pursue that. I wanted to have an opportunity to study Torah without tests or exams or papers or finals or teachers looking over my back, just because I wanted to study. And I had heard a lot about the yeshiva world and going to yeshiva in Israel, so I decided I was going to do this for a year. I didn't realize it would turn into a little bit longer, but... And because we were finishing high school, the high school that I was in had this opportunity to do what's called a Beit Midrash program, a program of study that was a little more intense in 12th grade. If you finished your 11th grade, you know, your high school requirements in 11th grade... So there were a few of us who sort of did all our achievement tests and regions and everything else, SATs, PSATs, whatever ATs you took. And we finished this at the end of 11th grade. And in 12th grade, I had a chance to do some more serious learning, learning Torah. And then I went to Israel to yeshiva for the year. And I thought, you know, one of the reasons that I actually took the year in 12th grade, when I was 17, to do this more intensified Jewish studies program in my high school, along with some college courses, was because I thought, you know, I'm going to yeshiva for a year. I'd already decided. And I was actually a little bit nervous. In fact, I was more than a little terrified about the prospect of going to yeshiva and studying. Was I going to be able to deal with sitting and learning Torah all day? So I figured if I spent a lot of time doing this when I was in 12th grade, it would help me prepare for it. And I got off the plane, and because I had finished my high school requirements, for various reasons, we had an early graduation at the end of May. So I figured rather than stay around for the end of the year, which anyway, you know, senioritis, the seniors are off in pizza land for the end of their high school year, I'd go to Israel and I'd get started a little early. So I got to Israel at the beginning of May. And I got off the plane, and I got to yeshiva, and I thought, you know, here it is, you know, I'm going to walk into this study of Torah, and the spiritual, you know, the angels are going to be dancing up there, and it's going to be unbelievable. I don't recall ever in my life that I have taken such a metaphorical fall as I did that morning. I got to yeshiva late at night, and they set me up with a room, whatever, and the next day I went to the Beit Midrash, and I figured, okay, now we're here! We're gonna start, right? So I got to the Beit Midrash, you know, to the house of study, and I didn't even know exactly what I was supposed to do. And I didn't know where there was a chair, what we were studying, so I finally found somebody who sort of helped me out, right? And said, oh, well, I think you're gonna be in Rabbi Bick's shir, in his study. This is what we're studying. Now, of course, the yeshiva was already in the middle of their study session. They had started right after Pesach. So I was coming in the middle of an issue. So they said, well, here's what we're studying. So I said, well, what do I have to do for class? You know, like, when is class? No, class, you know, you have to prepare for shiur for class. So, okay, when is class? Well, class is the day after tomorrow. Excuse me? Yeah, we have 2 days to prepare for the next class. I said, okay, you know, I was used to in high school, you would get an hour, you'd prepare for the class, you know, 2 days, what are you going to do for 2 days? So I said, well, what are they studying? So I said, well, we're in the middle of this tractate, it's called Kiddushin. It deals with contract laws in this particular section. And what you have to do is you have to study these two pages, these two folios of Talmud, and prepare them for class. I thought, okay, you know, I studied a little Talmud, I can do this, right? So the first hour I struggled. The second hour I examined the cracks in the ceiling. The third hour I started to wonder philosophically what on earth I was doing here, and by the fourth hour I was completely depressed. But the most depressing thing about it was that as I looked around me in the Beit Midrash, I saw these people were so into it. I mean, they were arguing and debating and considering, and they were posing questions and giving answers, whatever it might be, and I had no idea what to do. So I thought, you know what, I need a study partner. Now, as luck would have it, there was a second guy who was also coming around that time for various reasons. He was just coming for the summer. And someone found out that I had no study partner and he had no study partner. So the next morning he said, you know, we'll study together. So I figured, great, now we're going to study, we're going to get into it, we're going to ask questions, right? So this time, instead of me sitting on my own, having nothing to do, not having any idea how to approach the study of Torah, two of us sat together and had nothing to do and no idea about how to approach the study of Torah. And I remember thinking to myself, what on earth am I doing here? What is this book, this series of books, this library of books that we call Torah? And how do I develop a relationship with it? It's very rare in life that you find something that you want to enjoy. Normally, if you find something you enjoy, so you pursue it. And if you don't enjoy it, you don't pursue it. Nobody goes to medical school and says, I want to love to be a doctor. No. I want to be a doctor because I think I'm going to love being a doctor. If I know I'm not loving being a doctor right now, I won't bother to be a doctor. At least that's the ideal. Whoever finds a situation where I say, I wish I could fall in love with something. How do you do that? You don't meet a girl and say, I wish I could fall in love with you. I'm going to try to fall in love with you. No, you fall in love with her, so you pursue it. So what is that? And what is this entity called Torah? And what's it supposed to mean? And I want you to understand the underlying question that I'm asking here. They once told me about my Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Amital. I had a teacher who was actually the teacher of my teacher, who told me about Rav Amital, who was his teacher. Just so you understand the hierarchy here. Rav Amital is one of the two heads of the yeshiva where I learned. He's a Holocaust survivor. He was a partisan. He fought in the War of Independence. Tremendous individual. Tremendous Torah scholar. And once someone said a line to me that explained to me how a person becomes a Rosh Yeshiva, a head of a yeshiva. He says, you know, he had heard from somebody who learned with him when he was in yeshiva, when he was 19, 20, 21 years old, that he used to go to bed with a pile of books on Jewish law the way you and I curl up with a good book, like with a romance, whatever it is. He would, like, take the Rambam to bed. You know, he'd take an hour off, just curl up with a good Maimonidean thought. You know, let's curl up with the Bible. How do you reach that? How do you develop a relationship with Torah study that it not only motivates you, but it becomes the thrust of your desire for a given day? And I'll go you a stage further. How can I change the experience of Torah study from being an intellectual pursuit into something which actually changes who I am? Is there a system I can adopt that allows me to develop this? That's my underlying question. And I'll give you one last perception. This is now 1993. It was Yom Yerushalayim, Jerusalem Day, which is the anniversary of the day when Yerushalayim was recaptured in 1967. And in the yeshiva, I had gone back for a year to study, post-rabbinics, whatever, just to take a year and really pursue certain things that I hadn't finished. And I was learning. And on Yom Yerushalayim, they had a whole series of festivities that night. And Rav Amital, the same Rosh Yeshiva, came to give a lecture at night in the Beit Midrash. Now, there are two Roshei Yeshiva. There are two heads of the yeshiva in this particular yeshiva where I studied. The second one was a guy by the name of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. If you've never heard of him, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein is the closest approximation that I can think of to a living Torah. And this man is a living Torah. He's just, to look at this person, to be around this person, is to become ethically inspired. There's just no other way to describe him. And he's a Torah scholar, the likes of which I had never met before, and I've never met since. He's literally a walking encyclopedia. You cannot ask him a question and he won't know the answer. It's unbelievable. And this person just lives Torah. I remember discovering, you know, when I got to yeshiva, he has a principle that Torah should not be bound by time. Torah study, the study of Jewish identity and Jewish heritage, shouldn't be bound by time. So it's true that you have a class that's scheduled for 9 and it's supposed to finish at 11. How can you have a Torah class that finishes at 11? Torah class doesn't finish at 11. It finishes when the topic is exhausted. So if I'm discussing a topic in the tractate of Sanhedrin about the laws of Sanhedrin, I'm in the middle of the discussion, why on earth would I finish at 11? Don't get nervous. I have not completely adopted this technique. But, so, you know, the 11 o'clock class could finish at 12. The 11 o'clock class finish at 1, finish at 2. It's like Rav Riskin once told me a story that when he was a student and he was learning with Rav Soloveitchik, the great Rav Soloveitchik, who was probably one of the greatest authorities of the last generation. So Rav Soloveitchik used to come in from Boston and he would give a class and he was supposed to be there at 9 in the morning. And they would always find out exactly when he was arriving from the airport and when his class was from the janitor. The janitor always knew. So Rav Soloveitchik had said that he would be there for an 11 o'clock class. He would make it at 11. So 11 o'clock came, 11:30 came, 12 o'clock came, 12:30 came, he wasn't there. So they went back to the janitor, and you have to understand, you didn't leave if Rav Soloveitchik wasn't there yet. I mean, that was Rav Soloveitchik. This was the Rebbe of Rav Lichtenstein, just so you understand. So they went to the janitor, they said, well, do you know what time Rav Soloveitchik's class is supposed to start? He said 11 o'clock. So they chuckled, and they looked at him, and he says, like 12:30. And he looked at them, he says, if Rav Soloveitchik says that the class starts at 11, it starts at 11! And that's a whole different perception. So it was Yom Yerushalayim, it was Jerusalem Day, and this will allow me to get into the meat of our topic. It was Yom Yerushalayim, and Rav Amital was giving a discourse on the beauty of Jerusalem and the meaning of it and the sanctity of the temple and whatever he was discussing. And there must have been 800-900 guys sitting in the Beit Midrash. It was packed. And all of a sudden he noticed Rav Lichtenstein was standing in the back of the Beit Midrash, a huge, huge hall. Rav Lichtenstein had gotten there late. Rav Amital was already speaking. It would never occur to Rav Lichtenstein to walk in while Rav Amital was speaking, so he was standing in the back. Now the students didn't notice Rav Lichtenstein was standing in the back, because if they'd noticed that Rav Lichtenstein was standing in the back, they would have jumped up and given him a chair. So Rav Amital is in the middle of speaking, all of a sudden he notices Rav Lichtenstein, he says, no, come in, right? And you see Rav Lichtenstein goes through this body motion, the likes of which I've never seen. It was sort of, how can I disintegrate myself and completely hide my existence? Like he sort of didn't know where to go. Then he suddenly there's nothing for him to do, everybody noticed him, but to walk to his seat. So he walked to his seat, right? And as he walked to his seat, there's a beautiful custom, it's a halakha actually, when your teacher walks into a room at least once a day, some say twice, you stand up for your teacher. Not because your teacher needs that, it's a sign of respect for the Torah that teacher represents, right? The whole yeshiva rose up on its feet. 800-900 guys, all of them, in an instant, stood up, and the whole place stood while Rav Lichtenstein went to his seat. He, of course, just wanted to swallow himself up. And then Rav Amital went on with his lecture. And everybody sat down, and then Rav Amital went on with his lecture. And I remember thinking, what an awesome instant. What an opportunity to appreciate what Torah study is. It's not, after all, just an intellectual pursuit. There's something beyond it. How do I capture what that beyond is? So I want to give you a perception. And in the course of the process, I have to tell you I have two or three goals. First of all, I want to see, it's a very hard thing to express why you love something. That's very hard. Why I love my children. I don't know that I could do it. If you have children and you love your children, then you know why I love my children. But other than that, how do you express something like that? And yet that's one of my goals. And I don't know that I can do it by expressing it so much as by sharing it with you. The second of my goals is, can I actually impart to you at least the beginnings, because this is, you know, a year's worth of courses, but at least the beginning of a perception of how to go about acquiring Torah. How do I go about acquiring a relationship with this book, which is so magic, which is our history? And then the third is a sub-goal, which is to take an opportunity to actually study something together. Now I'll ask you a question. If I want to observe how an individual comes to develop a relationship with Torah, where would you think I would look? On any level. Where would you look? Well, I guess I would look in the Torah. I would expect the Torah to tell me how I go about acquiring Torah. Of course, one would wonder how one develops the desire to open up the Torah, but okay, where would you look in the Torah? How do you think there might be a place? Now think about this, and I want you to know one of the most amazing things about this is that, you know, what I want to share with you is something from the Torah that everybody overlooks. It's a little paragraph that to me is so mind-boggling and so crucial, and we miss it all the time. Not unlike the perception that I shared with you yesterday on the tour. We always look at the big things. You know, you can start a sentence and everybody knows the end of the sentence. The 10 commandments, right? Everybody knows that one. The creation of the... Everybody knows that because that's the Bible, right? I'm going to share something with you that most people have never even looked at, even though they hear it read in the synagogue all the time. So where would you look? If I was looking to develop a relationship with Torah, how do I acquire a relationship with this thing? You know, we call ourselves, I had a student once who said that we call ourselves the people of the book. But how many people actually open the book? And what is my goal? Is my goal as a human being, as a Jew, to just know that there's a book? To have a relationship with that book that we call Torah? Should I be opening it every day? Is it wonderful if I open it once a week? What can I actually concretize that? So I'll tell you where I think you would look. Because there is one instance in Jewish history where the Jewish people en masse actually had the opportunity to be given Torah. And it stands to reason that if they're given Torah, they have to go through a process to develop a relationship with Torah. I want to share with you that process. Because fascinatingly enough, the Torah takes the time to delineate what that process is. And in that process, I want to share something with you. I want to do something together. Some of you may have done this on your own before, some of you may have not, but I think that it'll be valuable for us, even if it's only for 5 minutes, just to give you a taste of what it is to transform a room into a Beis Medrash. To turn this room not just into a lecture hall, but into a Beis Medrash, into a living house of Torah study. So here's what I want you to do. I'm going to give you 6 or 7 verses, and I want to learn it together for a few minutes. But I don't want to teach you these 6 or 7 verses. I want you first to study it. The traditional yeshiva world always studies Bechavruta, the book of Proverbs, magnificent verse, Tovim hashnayim min ha'echad, two is better than one. Ki bin pola echad, because when one falls, he falls alone. But when two are together, one can never fall because the other will lift him up. And that's very true for the process of Torah study. So don't get me wrong, there is value to study on your own, but studying something on your own is fundamentally different from exchanging ideas with someone else. So what I want you to do is pick a chavruta. It doesn't matter to me who it is. It doesn't have to be a twosome. It can be a threesome, a threesome. But it should be a threesome. You can pick a partner. And what I want you to do is open up your chumashim to page 85. Okay? It's Parshat Yitro. It's the book of Exodus, Shmot, chapter 19, or Perek Yotet, verse 1. Perek Yotet, Pasuk Aleph. And what I want you to do is I want you to take a moment to learn this together with someone through Verse 1 to 6. Let's take 5 minutes, okay? And let's study this. Fair question. You're going to have to trust me on that one. You will always obviously be missing something until you know the whole Bible. But in order to get to know the whole Bible, you first have to read things without knowing the whole Bible. So that's, I guess, a catch-22. Sometimes you have to read a book in order to go back and read the book. Let me just ask you a simple question, okay? The floor is yours. What are your perceptions? What are your questions? What are your difficulties? What are your conclusions? What do you think? Just for a couple of minutes. With this section that I just gave you. Pardon? Ooh, that's a very interesting metaphor in the Torah. Va'isayetchem al kanfein nisharim. And I will carry you forth on the wings of eagles. Let's for the moment put that aside, because that's a lecture in and of itself. What an eagle is, that an eagle protects its young by flying high and putting itself at risk. It denotes a certain relationship. I would, by the way, go so far as to say that we have, or we may have, depending on whether you choose to see it, witnessed a perception of this in our day. And I actually heard this from a chavruta, study partner, who I had in yeshiva, who is Ethiopian, who described to me the first time they got on an airplane. And he said that they actually believed it was the fulfillment of the verse. And the kesim, the old, like, Ethiopian rabbis, such as they were, spiritual leaders, you know, started quoting this verse and saying it's a fulfillment of the prophecy. And of course, those of us, you know, in Israel for a while, Ashkenazim, so we chuckle cynically. But who's really right? It's an interesting question. Sometimes we spend so much time seeing things that we forget how we should be seeing them. But that's an interesting question. Okay, so, what else? Let's agree that the first stage is to realize that when you're reading English, you're reading a translation. Now, if I had a magic system to give everybody a command of the Hebrew language, but I will tell you this, even if you only know English, and if all you've actually been able to accomplish is to recognize the letters of the alphabet, okay, you can still go a long way to getting something out of the Hebrew without even understanding Hebrew. So you will remind me at the end of this class to describe it to you, because whenever I come across an opportunity to share a methodological system, there is a way, even without a command of the Hebrew language, very simply, to delve into the text in its original Hebrew. So remind me, okay? But alright, yeah? Let's make a habit, whenever someone quotes a verse, quote the verse. So we're in Pasuk Dalet, in verse 4, and it says that I carry you on the wings of eagles, va'avi etchem elai, and I brought you to me. Now that's a statement that doesn't make any sense. First of all, it means that there is somewhere that isn't me. And that doesn't make sense when we talk about at least the Jewish perception of God. How can you bring someone to God? God is everywhere. So we have to think about what that means. But okay, let's deal for the moment with perceptions and questions before we get to suggestions. Yeah, you wanted to, no? Yeah? Now that's a very interesting question. You know, this is a question that I get all the time here at Israel. We get here all the time. It almost seems as though I'm trying to create an elite unit. What does that say about the relationship between the Jewish people and the rest of the world? In fact, when you stop to think about it, and I will raise the question without giving you the answer today because that's a whole course that I offer at Israelite, I think, and we just did it now this past month. If I think that the goal of Judaism is to make the world a better place, if my goal is ultimately harmony among the people of the world, and I can find many sources for this, not least of which, by the way, is the end of the Aleinu prayer, on that day God's name will be one, and that clearly means the entire world, then I would think the last thing I want to do is to create a separate ism such as Judaism. And to say, you be separate from everybody else. That's an interesting question. But I will at least agree with you, if this is what you're suggesting, or maybe you don't know that you're suggesting this, that this would seem to be important somehow at the outset, before the Jews even received the Torah. Now that's an interesting question. What else? Okay, now that's another interesting question. If Torah is so important, why don't the Jews get the Torah in Egypt? Why do I keep the Jews waiting for 2.5 months until they get to the desert? For that matter, why am I giving the Torah to the Jews in the desert? First of all, by the way, that statement, by Yom HaZeh, seems to imply, which literally means on this day, on this specific day, seems to mean, from the Torah's perspective, that this isn't random. In other words, that this is an important day. Now, I would have thought that that meant, and I have to give you a little background here, the Jews have gotten out of Egypt. They've witnessed 10 plagues, the splitting of the sea, manna has been falling from heaven, no heavenly bread, and now they get into the desert of Sinai, and they come to the foot of Mount Sinai. In the 3rd month from that exodus from Egypt, they leave Egypt on the 1st day of Passover, the morning actually after the Seder, the 15th day of Nisan. They arrive in the desert at the foot of Sinai on the 3rd day of Sivan. So Nisan is the 1st month, right? Iyar is the 2nd month. Sivan is the 3rd month. So it's the 3rd month since, but it's not 3 full months. But okay, in fact, it's 6.5 weeks. Now, if this day, they're about to get the Torah on this day, then it would make sense to me. By Yom HaZeh, on this day, this is the big day. This is the day they get the Torah. You could argue that the whole reason that the Jewish people were created as an entity, the whole reason they were in Egypt, let alone got out of Egypt, was in order to receive the Torah. I would argue to you that that cannot make sense, but I'll save that for another class. But suffice it to say that if that's true, I would understand why I would say this day is an important day. But in fact, if you look at the Bible, that's not true. Because what they're going to be told now, in the continuation of this story, is that starting in the morning, they're going to have 3 days of preparation for that day. So that leads me to a very interesting question. What is this day? This day seems insignificant. Well, they arrive at Sinai. But having arrived at Sinai, they aren't getting the Torah yet. So I want to share with you a perception. And I think, by the way, that very often, and you know, when I was teaching in the yeshiva world, sometimes you get so involved in the detail, so deeply engrossed in the different perceptions of different commentators, that you lose sight of the simple beauty of the Torah itself. And I want to tell you 2 things, but I tell you them on condition that you don't assume for the moment that I assume that you agree with me. Matter of fact, I think it's a very healthy thing. It's one of the things I like about Israelite. That you disagree with me. Don't accept what I have to say. But it's important for me to share with you my perception just so that we're talking the same language. I guess you could argue that one of the most powerful questions with regard to Torah itself is what the source of that Torah is. I would venture to say that almost every major philosophical question in Judaism, maybe even in world existence, in our own existence, who we are, what we're looking for, can break itself down into one simple question. Do I consider this book divine or not? What is the source of this item that we're studying? Is this man-written, human being-sourced? Or, in fact, is this Torah divine? And I would at least suggest to you, without suggesting whether you should accept one or the other, that that decision, that assumption, is crucial when we learn Torah. If, for example, I look at this book as divine, it has to change the way I look at it. I'll give you an example that I mentioned during the last course of studies at Israelite. You know, I remember once, it was during the Gulf War, there was one of the assistants to the president, President Clinton, and he was giving a press conference to the press corps of the White House. And someone asked him a very tough question. How do you know when the spokesman for the White House has been asked a very difficult question? There's one sound that completely emanates from his lips. Have you ever heard someone do that? There is reason to assume that the forces, that's what Americans do. The Israelis translate this. The Hebrew translation for is, you ever hear, right? There is for to know that, now it stands to reason that God does not have the word in his vocabulary, her vocabulary, its vocabulary. You will not find the word in a speech by God. It doesn't make sense if there's a God. So that being the case, if this book is divine, every word, every letter, every syllable has to be significant. Now, I don't tell you for the moment that you should accept that. All of us here are from different backgrounds. Some of us may have already accepted that. Some of us are struggling with it. Some of us have concluded it's ridiculous. And it doesn't matter to me for the moment. But I think it's important as we continue this week that you understand my perception. Now, I unfortunately don't have the time, and if you're curious about this, you can feel free to bring this up tonight in the forum. But it's important that you realize that my perception is that this book is a divine book. Now, I want to rephrase this. I can't state this strongly enough. Even if I was giving you a class now on my perception of the divinity of Torah, I would not want you to accept what I have to say. I think it's a very dangerous thing to walk into a room with point A and walk out with point B just like that. You have to struggle with it. But it is important for you to realize that certain things won't make sense unless you understand what my perception is. And by the way, and this is my second thing, I would go a stage further. I think there's a value sometimes. This is a general rule of life. You'll see this tomorrow when we walk through Mea Shearim. If you want to understand something, one of the most simple things you can do is to try to put yourself into the perception that you completely disagree with. I'll give you an example. There was a terrible incident here on Shavuot. In the morning of Shavuot, you may have heard of it, it was in old papers. People throwing things, yelling at each other, whatever it was. And you can imagine, just from the little you've met me, that I have my vehement disagreements with what may have happened on both sides of the coin. I cannot disagree with someone unless I'm first convinced, as much as I can be humanly convinced, that I understand where he's coming from. I think one of the most un-Jewish acts that a person can do is to throw a rock on Shabbat. It makes no sense when you stop to think about it. But I can't disagree with someone throwing a rock unless I first understand the pain of the individual who's throwing it. And that works on both sides of the coin. So the same is true here. One of the things you can do if you want to understand the perspective of someone, let's say like me, is to try to read the Torah as though it's divine. You know, let's put aside for the moment whether it is or it isn't. Imagine for the moment that it is and read it as though it's divine. And watch how it changes the way you read it. Okay? So that's just an aside. I don't know everybody's background, but that's a perception. Having said that, let's take a look at this. Because I would venture to say that one of the things that we do in life is that we so focus on the goal that we lose sight of the journey. We are impressed by the bombastic, by the magnificent. And the Torah continuously, again and again, tries to steer us away from that mistake, from that misimpression. And this is a perfect example. The entire relationship, as I develop it with Torah, is specifically set up to lead me away, in most instances, not in all, from that bombastic. And here's an example. I'll tell you what I think this section is. Because what the Torah is coming here to tell me, this is the Jews' arrival at Sinai. Now, the Torah doesn't have to do this. And this little discussion that God has with Moshe seems to make no sense. Now, if this Torah is divine, it must be that God thinks this is the most important thing for Moses to communicate to the Jewish people as they arrive at Sinai. And of course, the arrival at Sinai is the arrival at the opportunity to receive Torah. So you have to ask yourself, how does one receive Torah? How does one receive revelation? How do I develop a relationship with this thing we call Torah? Well, the most incredible thing is that the Torah seems to give us a system. And I want to take you through that system. Look at these verses. In the third month, I will never get the hang of this. In the third month, the Jewish people come to the desert of Sinai. They get to a desert. They've traveled, and they come to the desert of Sinai. Now look how the Torah repeats that. It says it in verse 1. Vayom azeh ba'u, midbar Sinai, they came.
And then it says it again in verse 2. Vayavahu Midbar Sinai, they come to the desert of Sinai. So it seems to me that the first thing that happens here is Vayavahu. Right? Let's call this for the moment number 1. Vayavahu, they came. What's the next thing that they do? First it says Vayis'u. Vayis'u Merifidim. Right? They traveled. Then it says Vayavahu, they came. What does it say next? Vayachanu. Vayachanu is they encamped. Now it also says Vayichan. We'll see whether we get to that. That's an interesting question. Okay? Which literally means he encamped, although there is no accurate English translation. What's the next stage? After Vayachanu. What do they do next? Now comes along God. Says something to Moses. Moses goes to talk to God. God talks to Moses. Now God gives Moshe a message. And it's very interesting, and you will find this everywhere in the Torah. Moshe has never given a message from Moshe. The whole principle of the Torah is that Moshe is given a message to give over. So God comes along to Moshe and he says, listen, I got something to tell you. And I want you to tell it to them. Now let's for the moment assume that this means that at this stage, the Jewish people have arrived at Sinai. They are ready to receive Torah. This is what you have to tell them. So look what it says. Atem ri'item asher asiti l'Mitzrayim. You have seen what I did to Egypt. Now, if you read the continuation of these verses, it's clear that God wants Moshe to repeat this whole message to the Jewish people. Did you ever listen to somebody make a speech or ask you for something or introduce a meeting, and you have that certain, what I call the no time time? In other words, there's the first part of the speech that you don't need to hear, like the person reviews whatever it is you already know, or the person is giving you the introduction, building up to asking you the question, and you're already thinking, okay, what's the question? Right? Doesn't that seem to be what Hashem is doing? You have seen what I did to Egypt, and you expect the Jewish people to stand there and say, duh, thank you very much. I mean, obviously you've seen what I did to Egypt. Why would God tell that to the Jewish people? If it's a human being, it makes sense. It makes no sense for God to be saying this. So what is that? But okay, he says, you've seen, right? Ra'item. You've seen. What's the next thing that God says after you've seen concerning the Jewish people? Right? You've seen that I did to Egypt. I brought you here on the wings of eagles. I brought you to me. Ve'ata, and now. Im shamoa tishma'u bekoli. If you will listen. Okay? Im shamoa tishma'u. Well, let's look at what the word means. Where do I know this word from? The Shema, right? Not only from there, but the Shema. What is the Shema? Hear, listen, okay? If you will hear, okay? So we'll just call it hear. You could call it listen. Okay? What's the next? If you will listen, okay, to my voice, Ushmartem, continuing in verse 5, and you will, it's very hard to translate this word, you will keep my covenant. Let's say Ushmartem, right? Keep. Maybe a better word would be fulfill. The Brit. We're going to call the Brit, I mean, obviously every Hebrew word needs to be thought about. Let's for the moment call this fulfilling the covenant. Now, of course, if somebody doesn't know exactly what Lishmor Briti means, translating it as fulfilling the covenant doesn't really help us. So what does fulfilling the covenant mean? But let's call it that for the moment and pretend that we've actually understood it. Okay? I just want to go through and then we'll, okay? What comes next? Then vehiyitem li, you will be to me, zgula. Now what does the word zgula mean? Okay? That's a very interesting word. Literally a gift, a treasure. You will be to me a gift. Vehiyitem. You will be a treasure among the nations and a mamlechet kohanim, kingdom of priests, and the last thing, the goy kadosh, and a holy nation. Let me tell you what I think this is, and then I'll tell you why I think it's so. And I have to tell you that each of these stages is a class and a discussion and a day on its own. This is the system for developing a relationship with Torah.
This is what you as a people need to realize. This is what you have to do. This is your goal with Torah that I'm giving to you, says God, before I actually give it to you. In other words, this is a series of stages. You know, you ask the question, you look at this, and I guess one of the processes in each of us in our own level, you begin to develop a sense for how much is in this book. And it can be a little overwhelming. I mean, that's just this book, without all the commentaries on this book, and the Mishnah, Talmud, and the later authorities. Where do you begin? So it's almost as if Hashem is saying, this is where you start. This is where you begin. Now this is fascinating to me. Because, and if you want to take one of these and mark it on here, you're more than welcome to, but look at these stages. I'll give you an example of two or three of them. And I will tell you that these classes, for me, have the same goal as the tour did yesterday. I don't think anybody here imagines that they are going to get the sum total of Jewish study in a week. So I view this week as an opportunity to whet your appetites. So if in any given class I present you with a system, but we don't finish off the class, it's because you don't really need me to finish off this class. You can pursue the different stages in the system on your own. But let's take a look at two or three of them just to get a sense of what this is. Look at what the first stage of developing a relationship with Torah is. You have to realize you're on a journey. It's not accidental that Hashem doesn't give the Jewish people the Torah in Egypt. They're not ready for it in Egypt. You can't get Torah if you're still in Egypt. In order to develop a relationship with Torah, in order to develop a relationship with God, you first have to get out of Egypt. And more than you have to get out of Egypt, as the Maharal says, you have to get Egypt out of you. And that's not a simple thing. We all have our own Egypt. And we all are in our own Egypt. And very often people look at this as an intellectual exercise. They say, well, how do I get this? It's almost as if the Torah is saying, if you want to develop a relationship with Torah, first you have to figure out where you are. Where are you? Who are you? Who am I? Where am I? Where do I have to go? What's my journey? And while it may be that this book, this Torah, this perception, this identity, this heritage, this culture, allows me almost a look into how I can find out who I am, that is the first question that I ask myself. Where am I? What is my journey? You know, it's fascinating. Almost every important introduction in Judaism is involved with a journey. Give me the best example. Abraham. God comes to Abraham and says, and it's an unbelievable perception when you think about it. I mean, Abraham has never met God before. The beginning of the life of Abraham, all we know is that Abraham is born. God never talks to Abraham. Finally, if we're to believe all the rabbinic legends, you know, Abraham breaks idols and he goes hunting and he goes looking and he finds God. So God comes to him. What does God say? Get out of here. It's not exactly nice. God's opening lines in general are very strange, as I mentioned to you yesterday. So the first thing God says to Abraham is go. If you want to find me, you first have to go. You have to find you. Lech lecha. You have to find yourself. Who are you? By the way, we do the same thing every week. How do I begin the Shabbat service, the introduction to Shabbat, Kabbalat Shabbat? Lechu neranana la'asem. Go and sing to God. It's a very strange statement. What do you mean go and sing to God? Which is the first psalm that I say on Friday night. It should say, come and sing to God. No. If you want to develop a relationship with Shabbat, first you have to get out of the week. You have to let go of the week. In order to let go of the week, you have to realize that the week is in you. So you have to know where you are. Fascinating. Sometimes the difficulty is in realizing that you have to slow the journey down. That's exactly what the next stage is. Vayachanu. Right? You have to realize vayavo that you've gotten somewhere. And we do that all the time. I mentioned that as well yesterday. It's not accidental that these ideas came up yesterday. Realize where you're at. Give out. You're so busy looking to where you're going, you don't realize you've already gotten there. You know, I once met, it's just such a mind-boggling perception. I was absolutely dumbfounded. There was a student that I had who was 33 years old, he got married. And because he was in the yeshiva world, for him, he considered it, whether that's true or not, I don't know that there's an objective, but he felt it was really late, and certainly for years before, and he'd wanted to get married. And he finally got married. He met a wonderful woman, and they got married. And about 2.5, 3 years later, they had their first child. They had a son. And I went to the Brit, and I was talking to him like 2 weeks later, right? And I said, you know, how's it going? You know, you have a son, you're married, it's so wonderful. I remember when you were 30, it seemed so far off. He looks at me, he sighs, he goes, wow. Because I look at people with 3, 4, 5 children, how do you afford it? How am I going to put this kid through college? It's such an awesome responsibility. I'm thinking like, gewalt. You just had a baby boy, you're worried how you're going to pay for college? Don't worry so much about where you're going. Appreciate where you're at. Vayavon. You've gotten somewhere. And I want to tell you something. There's a tremendous danger in arrival. When you feel you've arrived somewhere, it has the danger of preventing you from continuing your journey. Look at the story of the Jewish people in the desert. You would think that the goal is to get to Sinai. Not so. Sinai is a stage. Rav Soloveitchik suggests that there are two mountains that are important in Judaism. Mount Moriah and Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai is important because we got the Torah, but it means nothing to us as a place. We gave it back in the peace agreement with Egypt. Nobody even put up a fuss. It wasn't a big deal. The Jewish people get to Sinai out of Egypt. They receive the Torah. Can you imagine? How could you ever leave Sinai? 40 days later, they leave. How could you leave? You got to Sinai. Because Sinai is merely a part of a system. It's one more stage that allows me to get where I'm going. And that where I'm going, I guess, is the goal of Judaism. Whatever you want to call it, to make the world a better place, a more ethical place, however you look at it. So the Jewish people now have done two things. Vayisu, they've left Egypt. Vayavo, they've come somewhere. Now comes a very important stage of Vayachanu. And it's interesting that in Vayachanu there are two stages. They encamped. What does it mean to make a camp? And I want to tell you, by the way, what I find beautiful about this relationship with Torah. And this, by the way, is the Maharal. The Maharal of Prague, who was one of the greatest Torah authorities, mystical commentary, lived in Prague in the 16th century, if I'm not mistaken. No, 17th century. Most people know him as famous for the Golem of Prague, but that was such a small part of who he was. He wrote a magnificent set of books. Some of them have been translated into English. And he has a perception of Torah study. Sometimes the most beautiful thoughts in Torah can come, not because you've read Maimonides, or you've read Rashi, or you've read Nachmanides, or all the different commentaries in the world. Because if you look at a section of Torah, and you go right to Rashi, you go right to the Rambam, to the commentaries on Torah, then you're not learning the Torah, they are. And they're telling you what they learned in the Torah. Before you learn a commentary in the Torah, you have to develop an individual relationship with Torah. And it's amazing how much you can do just by reading. And on purpose, I'm not quoting you any commentaries. And there's nothing here, I promise you, once you look for the perception that you can't find on your own. Now, this brings up two questions. One question is, well, how do I know I'm right? I mean, this is all very nice. I study some Torah, I come up with a nice idea, how do I know I'm right? Who says that's the divinity of Torah? That's the first question. And the second is, just as an aside, which was one of my original goals, is how do I develop this as a methodology? So I want to tell you three things. First, I had a student who had a profound impact on me with something that he said. We were sitting one Friday night at dinner, and he was sharing with me some of the philosophies that he'd discovered in Buddhism. I was quite amazed. I don't know enough about Buddhism, but I was quite amazed to discover that Buddha was not the first Buddha, that there are many, many Buddhas before, and he was defining for me what a Buddha was, how a Buddha works. And Buddha is someone who's reached a higher state and returned, and enlightenment, whatever. And we were talking about some of the beauties within Buddhism. And he was saying to me, you know, there's a lot of beauty that I see in Judaism. And I said, you know, it's funny you say that, because I hear in what you're telling me about Buddhism many things that I know in Judaism. So he said to me in such a simple line, sometimes the greatest beauties are the most simple. He said, well, you know, truth is truth. If something is true, then it's true everywhere. Now, I have thought a lot about that statement, and I think that's true. You know how you know if something is true? You know it's true because it fits with everything else. If I study something and I have many questions on a given section, and I come up with a perception, that perception has to be able to give response to all of my difficulties. This has to fit not only here, it has to fit everywhere else that I ever see. So if I come up with a perception, and it's my perception, it's my relationship with Torah,
I may not know today whether it's truth. I may not know whether it's right. It feels right. It fits with this story. And then next week I'm studying something else and I realize that what I study today fits with what I'm studying next week. It becomes a little truer. And a month later I'm studying a whole different story in the Talmud. And all of a sudden I realize that what I studied the other day, that fits too. It becomes a little truer. And the process of developing a relationship with Torah is a process of awareness, of perception, of gradually making it true. And that brings me on the boat. Look what Hashem says. Tremendous. First of all, Vayachanu. You have to encamp. So we'll get back to Vayachanu. But the next thing that he says is, Atem Re'item, you've seen. What does Re'iyah mean? What does a perception mean? And how does this relate to Chanaya? So I want to tell you something. The Talmud has a tremendous statement. It says, the Hagita Bo, right? The Pasuk, the verse says, it actually is mentioned in the book of Joshua. Joshua is in the middle of a campaign to conquer the land of Canaan at the behest, so it seems, in the Bible of God. And all of a sudden, in the middle of this whole story, you know, I mean, the walls are tumbling down, Jericho, battles, incredible. Shofar blasts. There's a little side story. It's kind of like this little side story. It doesn't really get noticed because everybody's too busy looking at the walls of Jericho tumbling down. And Joshua, it's in the evening, at the end of a day's battle, and an angel comes to Joshua. Joshua sees the angel and falls to his knees. And the angel comes to Joshua and he wants to kill him. And he says, Lo yamush Torat Hashem mipicha. The word of God is not supposed to leave your mouth. V'hagita bo yomam v'layla. You're supposed to struggle with it. You're supposed to study with it day and night. And it becomes clear when you look at the story that Joshua is so busy waging the battle of God that he's forgotten to study the Torah of God. It says. So Joshua immediately supplicates for the angel, talks to God. Nothing works. He starts to study Torah. And the angel disappears. It's a very difficult story. I'll tell you what I think it means. The Torah there is giving me a perception of what a relationship with Torah is supposed to be. And how a relationship with Torah, with Jewish identity, the Jewish heritage, is different from any other book that you'll come across. It can't be that when you read the book is in you. But when you put it back on the shelf, it gets left behind. The goal of developing a relationship with Torah is that the Torah never gets put on the shelf. It's something that's constantly a part of your struggle. And that's a fascinating idea. What does it mean, Vayachanu, to encamp? When you're encamped, it means that the thought process that you're undergoing, it's a part of you. It's not something you can leave. And I don't think that God is saying that I have to encamp in the Torah. It's that the Torah has to be encamped in me. And it's interesting, the verse that suggests this to Joshua, and who after all has more of an excuse not to study Torah than Joshua. It says, V'hagita bo yomam v'layla. You shall struggle with it. It doesn't say study it, it says to struggle with it. Day and night. Now there's a fascinating halachic discussion. Let me ask you a question. Let's assume for the moment that I'm supposed to study Torah day and night. Well, what that means is that if I'm sitting in the lunchroom and I'm hearing a good joke about doctors, so I'm violating a principle. How can I not be studying Torah? If I walk out on the street and someone gives me an article and I'm reading the article, I'm not studying Torah, how can I not be studying Torah? So the halakha discusses this and says, no, in fact, the obligation is just to study for a moment in the day and to study for a moment in the night. That's what the halachic perception is. And I've always wondered about that. Why would the halakha come up with an idea like that? As if to tell me I should only study a moment in the day and a moment in the night. And for a long time that I thought that what that meant was that if you study for a moment in the day and a moment in the night, you won't be able to put it down, you'll end up studying more. I'm not so sure that's what it means anymore. I wonder if the issue is not that my day and night should be a struggle of Torah. See, if I think that I'm studying Torah at 9 a.m., and I'm reading an article of Kant or Kierkegaard at 10, and that those are two different things, then I've missed the boat. The moment of Torah study that I have at 9 in the morning should mean that the reading of the article on Kant or Kierkegaard at 10 is a function, is a part of that Torah study. If I walk down the street, and someone says good morning, and I'm capable of walking by that human being without smiling, then something's wrong with me as an ethical person. It means that the Torah isn't encamped in me. And that everything that I do is a process of that relationship. Literally to become a living Torah. Can you make it your encampment? Can you make Torah your home? Can you discover a system which is so valuable that it becomes a part of who you are? And it's a gradual process. It's a very dangerous thing to assume that this process, either A, you ever get there, or that B, you've ever finished searching for it. But that's the third stage. And that stage is supposed to lead to the next stage, which is Ri'iyah. You know, I'll tell you something. When I was in basic training, I was in the army. So I came out of the yeshiva world and I went to the army. You can imagine that's a pretty drastic change. And one of the things that I found most difficult was adjusting. You know, you live in the yeshiva world, it's such a pure environment. You know what I mean? Everybody's involved in studying, and Torah, doing acts of kindness. You know, you go to there's a beautiful custom that the yeshiva in Kelm, which was an ethical yeshiva of the Musa movement, of the ethical movement, when a student would go up to wash his hands before eating the bread, right? So he wouldn't take a bucket, or whatever, a netilat yadayim, a cup, fill it with water and wash his own hands. He would take a cup, fill it with water, and wash the hands of the next person after him. Then the next person, having just washed his hands before he left, would fill the cup and wash the person after him. Fascinating idea. As if to say that every stage becomes part of a ritual affectation. And then you go to the army. and it's the opposite. You know how hard you have to look in the army for ethics. It's so difficult. And instead of being involved in study of Torah and prayer, you know, you're grunting and running around in the field and sweating. And I remember I had determined, quite naively, before I went into the army, that I was going to have a learning project, and I was going to learn every day, whatever. I remember that a friend and I decided we were going to study the Mishnayot of Brachot, the first tractate of the Mishnah of the oral tradition. Just the Mishnah, not the Talmud, just the Mishnah. And we actually made a little party for the guys, you know, we brought out some potato chips, whatever, on the day we finished the tractate. It took us 3 months. At the end of basic training, we finished the tractate. Now you have to understand, we didn't go into all the commentaries. We just literally read through it, discussed it for a minute, and went on to the next Mishnah. It took us 3 months. I could study that Mishnah today in about an hour. 3 months! So if you look at the study of Torah as a quantity, that's a whole different world. But if you're living in an environment where you're struggling with Torah, then the issue is not the quantity, the issue is the struggle. And there's no doubt in my mind that the value of that Torah study, the minutes that we were able to find during our day, was much more valuable than the hours to me that I put it in yeshiva. What does it mean to see? You know, we had a discussion about this in our Israelite program. There's an incredible statement in the Talmud. We have to finish. The Talmud says, "Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyirat shamayim." What was in the hands of heaven, except for anybody? What does yirat shamayim mean? Does anybody know? Awe of heaven, the fear of heaven. That's how people translate it. It's an incredible mistake. Because the word yirah doesn't really mean fear. And it doesn't really mean awe. It means lirot, to see. Yirat Hashem means to actually see God, to perceive God. Do I change my perception? Atem ru'item. Have you seen? Has your perception changed? The development of a relationship with Torah is actually to change your perception. That's part of the challenge. Moshe says when he sees the burning bush, Asura na ve'er'eh, I will turn aside and see. I want to try to understand, to perceive what I'm seeing differently. The true value of an experience is whether that experience changes your perception. And with that, I'll give you one last piece of food for thought. How do you develop a relationship with Torah of love? I want to tell you something. Study Torah, and you can find what the Torah has to say to you. If I study a section of Torah, and we come up with an objective, a black and white perception of what that Torah is supposed to mean, and I tell you this is what the Torah means, we haven't learned anything. You've heard me give a thought. Very often it goes in one ear and out the other, and I can guarantee you that 6 months from now you won't remember what I said. That's not a relationship with Torah. But if I can study Torah and I can figure out what I think that Torah means to me, if I've made a journey, if I'm trying to make my camp that perception, that reality of Torah, and if as a result of my study, it means something to me, it changes who I am. It changes my journey. It changes my path. It makes me want to become something different. I hear things differently. I see things differently. Shmirah is action. I actually change the way I behave. That's how I develop a relationship with Torah. And that's really the challenge I want you to know in everything that you do, by the way, here at Israelite. And in general, people often make the mistake of hearing a lecture. Somebody comes, you know, you go sit in Rabbi Kadosh's home. And he's giving you a lecture. If you look at it as a lecture, you'll miss half the boat. It's a struggle. And the real question of that lecture is not whether you heard a nice idea, but does it change who you are? What does it mean to you? And if two people can sit in a room and hear a lecture and both come away with the same conclusion, something's wrong. Because it can't be that my Torah is your Torah. That's part of what it means, vayichan. There are many different perceptions of what that means, the unity of the Jewish people. One perception is that vayichan means I have to view it as my encampment. What is this Torah to me? The first commandment, God says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am your God. Forget everybody else. There isn't a standard. What is your relationship with this thought process? How do you develop a relationship with it? If I study the story of Abraham, or the story of Adam, or the story of Moses, what does it teach me? What do I learn from it? If I look at lifting up a lulav, or blowing a shofar, or eating a piece of matzah, what does it do to me? How does it change me? How do I become a different human being as a result of my perception of that mitzvah? That's what it means to develop a relationship with Torah. And that's the challenge. And what I wanted to show you, I don't know if I succeeded, is that you don't need to have a mountain of commentaries. You can simply attempt to do this on your own by studying text. It's a magnificent perception. And I want you to know the most fascinating thing is that when you do this on your own, this gets into deep Kabbalah, which is that the soul has the essence to discover truth, but that's another discussion. You will very often be amazed to discover that you'll then open up the commentaries and you'll find them saying what you already said. What a world of difference. To read the Ramban and to hear the Ramban not saying something that makes sense to you, but saying what you already said. That's how you fall in love with Torah. So there's a piece of food for thought. It's a perception. It's not accidental that the Torah is a tree, because a tree is growing and it gives fruit, and every year it gives new fruit. And I can never look at the Torah as a dead, closed issue, but a growing, living thing.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.